After that overview of factors that affect academic achievement, we're going to turn to three policy alternatives from across the political spectrum. We're going to discuss changes in the school aid formula, strategies for involving families and communities in school reform, and then ways of improving teacher practice. And our next speaker is Dr. Reshofsky, Andrew Reshofsky. He's a professor in the Robert M. La Follette Institute of Public Affairs and the Department of Agriculture and Applied Economics at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. He's also on the research staff of the Consortium for Policy Research and Education based at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research. Now, most of his research focuses on issues related to state and local government public finance. He's written about 50 articles in professional journals. He's a consultant to several federal agencies, to a number of state and local governments throughout the country. He's also given presentations in Paris, Shanghai, and Beijing. Just a couple weeks ago, he was in New Hampshire talking about school aid formulas, and a couple weeks he's going to Texas on the same topic. Welcome, Dr. Reshofsky.
I've been asked by Karen to talk about state aid in Wisconsin, state aid to K-12 education, primary and secondary education. This year, as many of you know, Wisconsin is distributing $3.7 billion in state aid to school districts. And if we add the indirect aid in the form of the lottery credit, we can add another $500 million. The question I want to address this morning is, are we spending this money wisely? Are we distributing it in a way that achieves the state's educational goals and enhances the effectiveness of state dollars? And what I'd like to do is to suggest, in my standpoint, we should consider reforming school aid formulas. We can do a better job. And what I'd like to do is briefly review the current situation. And from the slide, which, and I gather you have a copy in the material that was handed out, you can see that of the $3.7 billion, about 90% is in the form of equalization aid. And equalization aid is distributed through a very complex three-tier formula, which I won't go into the details this morning. And the basic objective of most of this aid, equalization aid, is to weaken the link between per-pupil property values and spending per pupil, to allow poor districts, poor in terms of property value, to be able to spend as if they had more property wealth. This means in practice that with equalizing aid, school districts with equal tax rates are able to achieve approximately equal spending per pupil. And we've done a pretty good job in achieving that goal. The second objective of state aid is to achieve property tax relief. And here the revenue caps, I assume everyone knows about the details, are crucial to guaranteeing that more state aid won't be used to enhance increase spending, but to achieve property tax cuts. I think it's fair to conclude that most of the discussion in Wisconsin about the distribution of state aid has really focused on the distribution of money, how we divvy up the pot. What's been missing, in my view, is a direct focus on students, and in particularly on student performance, student outcomes. What do the schools do? Now, in recent years, in the last 10 years, in other states, there have been a series of court cases, state Supreme Courts, ruling that school finance systems in various states must be structured so that they provide all children in a state with an adequate education. And by adequacy, defining adequacy in terms of student performance. And the reference earlier this morning to the reading test scores at least suggests that not all children in Wisconsin are currently getting an adequate education. So it's one standard of adequacy, and adequacy isn't measured by just one thing, might be performance of a fourth-grade reading test or at fourth-grade reading level at the end of fourth grade, for instance. Now, focusing on equity, as we do, turns attention really away from student performance. Achieving equal student equal spending per student doesn't necessarily guarantee equal student performance. Thus, achieving a high degree of equity in school finance doesn't guarantee that the state system of school finance provides adequate education for all students. And now the critical link, I think, or one of the critical links, is that equal spending doesn't necessarily result in equal educational outcomes because costs are different across districts. In Wisconsin, this word cost I want to spend a while on, because we use in the state aid formulas at DPI, we talk about cost really meaning spending per pupil, as in shared cost. But that's really quite different from the way that business people and economists talk about costs. They generally refer to the value of resources necessary to provide some given level of good or service. Thus, the cost of education, as I would like to define that term, refers to the amount of money a school district must spend in order to achieve an educational outcome. So linking spending directly to performance. And the implication of this is that, of this definition, is that costs are different across school districts. And in other words, what that means is that in some districts, due to factors that the local school board has no control over, or very little control over, that school district is going to have to spend more money than other school districts in order to achieve any given educational goal. Now, there are two obvious questions. One, why do costs differ across districts? And two, how important in quantitative terms are these cost differences? And next one. Research in other states has suggested some possible reasons. And let me just mention them quickly. One is the characteristics of the student body. You may have students or a higher proportion of students with disabilities, mental and physical disabilities. You may have students coming into the schools who don't know much English. You may have students from low-income families coming into the school with much less parental support, requiring more educational resources, which cost dollars, in order to get them to perform at a given level. Within the state, there's some areas of the state, as we all know, where cost of living is higher, the Milwaukee metropolitan area, Madison to some extent. To get a teacher of a given quality with given qualifications, you need to spend more money. District size, there's quite a bit of evidence there are diseconomies of scale. We have lots of very small districts, particularly up north in this state. They need to have, still, every school needs a principal, a science lab, even though it's spread over very few pupils, that raises cost per pupil. Transportation costs in geographically large districts. Some evidence in some places that grade level, that high schools are more expensive than elementary schools. Now, I've recently completed a study funded by the U.S. Department of Education where what I've tried to do is to measure these costs. And we're going to look at a number of states, but we've started with, fortunately, with Wisconsin. And my approach has been to use detailed data on student test scores, on other levels of measures of student performance, on the characteristics of students, on the financing of each district, other characteristics of all 368 K-12 districts in the state, and to use that information in a fairly complex statistical model to estimate what's called a cost function. And a cost function allows one to statistically identify the characteristics of school districts and their student bodies that contribute to costs of providing any given educational outcome. To measure improvements in student performance, I calculated the difference in scores in the statewide eighth grade test, with scores in the 10th grade test by the same students 2 years later, sort of measure of educational improvement. And we can return to here. My results basically show the following, that on this list, having a high proportion of students with disabilities, particularly severe disabilities, was important. having students, a high concentration of students from low-income backgrounds contributed to cost substantially. High cost of living in the area, or low cost of living in the area was important, the amount you must pay to attract teachers. And both small district size and large district size raised costs. There were economies and diseconomies of scale. The average cost of providing any given level of education was lowest at districts with about 5,700 students. So smaller districts had higher costs than higher districts. Now, a major problem, turning back to the school aid formulas, a major problem with the equalization aid formula is that it takes no account of costs. Remember, the formula has in it spending or shared cost, but it's very important to realize that high spending doesn't necessarily mean high costs. There are obviously districts in this state that spend a lot of money per pupil because they value education very highly. They want a very high quality education, even if their costs are low. At the same time, they're low spending districts. That doesn't mean they're low cost districts. They may be fairly high cost districts, but they've decided, the citizens and the school board have decided, to accept a lower quality of public education. Now, major question is, how do we include information about costs in state aid formulas? And the answer is through something I call a cost index. Here's the next slide. And a cost index allows us to combine the information from the estimate of cost functions to isolate variation in school spending attributable to cost factors that are outside the control of local school boards, like the proportion of poor kids in a neighborhood or in a district, while holding constant things that are under the control of a school board. And I calculated cost indexes for all the K-12 districts in the states. And what do the results show? Just let me summarize them very briefly. One, costs do vary tremendously across districts. I'll give you the range. School districts with the lowest costs can achieve the average level of student achievement for about 40% less in dollars than school districts can achieve that goal with average costs. On the other hand, school districts with the highest costs have costs that are about 90% higher than the costs in the district with average costs. Now, that suggests an immense disparity. In fact, if you looked at sort of 80% of the districts, the range is from 21% below average to 27% above average. And let me give you an example. Next slide. From the city of Madison, where we are today, the cost index for Madison is 1.27. And what that means is that Madison will have to spend 27 more in dollars than the Wisconsin district with average cost in order to provide adequate education, which we've defined in terms of a performance measure, in this case, average statewide performance on the 10th grade statewide exam. Why does Madison have higher costs? There are a couple reasons that stand out. One, the higher cost of living in this area compared with the state, and the higher concentration of low-income students. As point of comparison, Stevens Point, for instance, has a cost index of 0.89, meaning that in Stevens Point they can provide an average education for 11% less than the statewide average. Why? Because cost of living is lower than average in that in Stevens Point, and their concentration of low income and disabled students is lower than average. Now, the question is, how do we use this cost index once we have it in state aid formulas? And let me suggest two possibilities. One, if the goal of school finance system remains the achievement of equity, if we keep the same goal as we currently have, we can take the existing equalization aid formula and adjust shared cost, the spending number that's in there now, by the cost index. And what would this do? This would guarantee that two districts with equal tax rates would generate the same amount or equal educational performance, not equal education spending. And it's student performance, I think, that's important, not dollars per student. What's the second possibility? A second possibility is to say that the goal of the state is to guarantee the achievement of educational adequacy, that all our students are adequately educated. And if the state wants to achieve adequacy, I would suggest that they use something that one might call a cost-adjusted foundation formula. And if we could have the next slide. This slide is also in your packet. And how does this work? GI is, and the little I means for each school district, any given school district, is the state aid. And the state is going to define a foundation level, $5,500 per pupil, $6,000 per pupil, something like that, where F star is the dollar amount necessary to achieve an adequate education in school districts with average cost. Now, the first thing the state has to do is, or policymakers have to do, is obviously define what we think is an adequate education. And if we have higher levels of performance as adequate, in some sense minimum standards, obviously F star is going to be a larger number. But that adequacy standards get defined, we cost it out, that's F star. Now, the important thing about this formula and what makes it different from foundation formulas in many states is that the foundation level differs by district because it's multiplied by that C sub I, which is the cost index. So in a district which, like Madison, that had costs that were, you know, 25 or so percent above average, the foundation level would provide more money. And state aid is then the difference between each district's foundation level and what that district can raise if it applies a state-imposed or state-mandated tax rate, T sub star I used. So the state may say you need to impose a 15 mil or 10 mil or whatever tax rate. Obviously, a high-wealth district like Madison will generate more money than a low-wealth district. So the two things that lead to more aid are, one, low per property wealth, EQV, or high costs. And the current state aid formula doesn't include any cost considerations at all. Let me make just a couple more points. One, and maybe this is good news for members of the legislature, I think that achieving adequacy does not necessarily mean that we need to spend more money. And my research actually suggests that if we defined adequacy as achieving average current performance on the 10th grade test, we could take the money we're now spending, that $3.7 billion in equalization aid and categorical aid, put it through a cost-adjusted, inflation-adjusted foundation formula, achieve adequacy for all students in the state with that amount of money. Okay, I want to, final concluding remark is that state aid just distributes money. And we can distribute it, I think, in a better way, in a way that will provide districts with enough money to achieve adequacy. But that doesn't guarantee that school districts will actually provide their students with an adequate education. What is necessary is strict accountability standards. The state needs to play a more active role than it probably does now in seeing that achievement performance standards are actually met. And there's beginning to be new research on those kind of ways that they can do it. Incentive mechanisms, in some cases penalties, and people in the School of Education are studying this as we speak. New formulas plus accountability standards, I think, can guarantee that we can, in Wisconsin, provide an adequate education for all our students. Thank you.
Are there questions for Professor Oshofsky? Yes. The question is, has any state implemented a solution that you've just described?
I guess the answer is sort of yes and no. Several states are moving towards cost-adjusted foundation formulas. Foundation formulas per se, don't have any cost impact in it or cost effect in it, are widespread, probably two-thirds of the states. But pushed by a court case, partially pushed by a court case, Massachusetts now has a foundation formula where they cost out adequacy, and so the foundation level differs by school district. I think Ohio is currently moving in that direction, Wyoming is currently in that process. So this is a change that I think we're finding in a number of states.
Yeah. So politically, how are you going to implement a strategy like this where you're going to redistribute money, you're going to have some winners and losers? Any advice on that?
A few years ago, my colleague Mike Wiseman and I wrote a paper that was... This was before the state moved to two-thirds funding and where the state added $1 billion to the pot, basically. And the subtitle of our paper was something, A Reform Opportunity Lost. And in some sense, that was motivated by this concern that politically, usually you need new money if you're going to change the formula. And I think it would have been much easier if we would have, when we moved to two-thirds, change the formula. It obviously will be quite difficult because any new formula means that some places that are doing well now are going to do less well. And I think maybe the only political answer is, one, if the case gets made convincingly that we're not spending our money wisely, and it almost certainly has to be implemented over, phased in over a period of years. We're not going to tell a district, for instance, a district with very low cost that's doing quite well under the current formula, hey, you're going to lose 20% of your aid tomorrow. But over 10 years, one could have those changes. It's not going to be easy politically.
Okay, the question is, what about rewarding schools who are doing well? And we need a brief answer.
Okay. I'm not an expert on this. My colleague in the School of Education, Alan Auden, has been working and studying Kentucky. And in Kentucky, again, mandated by the court, they've imposed a system of rewards and some penalties. And I turn your attention to Alan's work because they've done a very complete evaluation and I think would be ready to come before the legislature and say how one could do that here.